Hot Rod Zombies, Ghoul Girls, Creepy Chicks, and Rockin' Skeletons. Tune in next week for part two of the Monster Billy Horror Rock Extravaganza here on the Wrecking Hours. Up next is the Monday Talk Forum with Parent Connection, an original WHFR Talk Forum show. Catch you next week. Happy Halloween, everybody.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
WHFR, Dearborn. This is a pre-recorded program.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go.
Hi, and welcome. You're listening to Parent Connection. Very much for tuning in. In the studio today, this is a pre-recorded program, and I must tell you that the views expressed here do not reflect the station, the staff, or administration of this college at HFCC. So let me begin by just inviting you to welcome our guest here today. We have Michael Shelton. He's the Director of Special Education. He has about 25 years as a special ed teacher, and we have Claire Brick, who is a regional parent mentor. Yes, from the Michigan Alliance for Families, right? Parent of a child in Dearborn receiving special ed services. Dearborn Parent Advisory Committee is also something you serve on here for Wayne County, and treasurer for the Dearborn Special Ed PTA. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Margaret.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we're thrilled that you're here. And we're going to be advocates today for the special needs population. So this program is really about knowing your rights, what are the rules, as you raise your children in society today, even in Dearborn, in Michigan, because this is where this program is being aired, right here at HFCC, the Community College campus. So let's start with knowing that I have a sister who has special needs, and Claire has a son that has special needs. Michael, are you also
I have a classroom. I have three stepsons and two daughters.
Oh, right. Very good. So I've had the pleasure to work with both of these wonderful people in the district. I'm the parent involvement educator, and so we collaborate on a lot of programs and projects and getting the word out to the parents and empowering the parents, if you will. So let's start with just the state of Michigan and what is their role as advocates for the parents that are raising children here in Michigan with special needs. And either way, just signal to each other who's going to talk first and who's going to do what, and that'd be fine.
A little bit of history about special education law. Really, in 1975 was the first real act that directed parent rights in regards to students with disabilities, and that was the Education for All Handicapped Act, and it was enacted in 1975. Today it's been renamed, it is renamed the Individuals with Education Improvement Act, and it's been revised and really guided some of the decisions that we're at right now in special education. So prior to 1975, a lot of students with disabilities were denied an equal opportunity in our educational system. So we've come a long way. No Child Left Behind also had a big impact in special education. It really raised the bar for academic excellence for all students, especially students with disabilities. So those were all the things that were very important and really guide a lot of the decisions that we make in our field right now.
Okay. And Claire, do you want to add anything to that?
I think the main thing is, like Michael had said, there is quite a history involved in students with special needs being denied access to the general curriculum, access to school in general. Back before 1975, there were many students who never went to school at all.
I don't even think about that.
Because they were not, there was something, I think it was called like a card, a green card or something, that if you saw a child out, they had a card that said they had a disability, that they were exempt from school.
They were denied.
Yeah. So what did parents, parents couldn't do anything, right? Parents had to kind of homeschool back then, I guess.
I think the expectations of the abilities of people with disabilities have grown leaps and bounds since then.
Right.
Back then, there was a lot more institutionalization of children with disabilities. There were no expectations in terms of learning and growth for those students.
Right.
So with this act in 1975, I mean, that really put these students in schools and in society as a whole, because they had been segregated from all that.
Okay. So as far as those rules changing or implementing new rules or reviewing, who gets to look at those rules and see if they're still fitting the needs of the special needs population?
Well, the federal government really dictated, they came out of Supreme Court cases, led to these laws. Now it's up to each state to enact them and review them and make sure that they're in compliance with those laws. And we look at the Michigan Rules for Special Education as really our guiding book. Whether it's with Claire and her group, we all carry that with us. It has all our administrative rules for special ed within that book.
Well, and the beauty of living here in Michigan is the federal law, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, has its set of guidelines, and Michigan's rules actually go above and beyond what those guidelines are. So we're lucky to have our students here in Michigan, because we are afforded kind of more than what the federal law dictates.
Good point. We service students all the way up to age 26 for special education.
Well, the federal law stops at age 21.
Wow.
And actually, I think it goes 3 to 21, whereas in Michigan it goes 0 to 26.
Oh, my gosh. Now, what happens for people, though, after 25 or 26? Do they go into vocational school? How do they fulfill their lives as individuals and functioning people in the community and, you know what I mean, holding a job and things like that? Does that ever happen?
Well, there's a lot of choices. It's really individualized. But the state, Michigan Rehabilitation Services, picks up a lot of our students and provides support for vocational and just some of the daily living needs that they may have.
Yeah.
The community mental health program through the state offers support. And it starts in school, because in school they have something called the IEP,
right,
which is the Individual Education Program.
Mm-hmm.
And an integral part of that program is when they're approaching the age of 16, they have something called a transition plan.
Oh.
So that's taking in all the things that they're going to need to be successful out of school and in the community.
Okay.
So that's where those things come into play, vocational training, life skills, those kind of things. And then the contact with those outside agencies help with that. And community mental health helps with housing and you know, support in that way. And then Michigan Rehab Services helps with the job training and so forth.
Okay, so let's go and talk about the IEPs then. Okay. Let's talk about the role the parent should play in the IEP. When does the IEP start up for a child starting? Is it right when they start up in school, kindergarten or first grade, or is it just, does it come later? What is the, you know, what should parents, how should parents be involved in that, and what does that look like?
Well, first of all, a student, in order to have an IEP, you must be identified and have eligibility as a student with a disability.
Who does that? Who decides that?
Whenever a parent or a staff member suspects a disability, we go to request an evaluation. We have a school psychologist that would ask the parent to sign that request to evaluate. There are 13 different areas of identification that the state has, and there's criteria for each one of those eligibilities. So that would start the process. We have our psychologist, and whatever, depending on the eligibility, would really involve other people that would be a part of that evaluation.
So all in-house, right, in the school.
We must provide that for all students in the Dearborn Public Schools and to our non-public schools as well.
Okay, but my question is that it can happen right in the school, the testing. It's not something that you have to send the child to another doctor or to a hospital or somewhere else.
No. We're in an educational setting. It has to be educational relevant. Yeah. So we have our criteria, and it's all based on the state guidelines.
Okay.
And there's a law called Child Find that obligates schools to identify those students that they suspect have a disability. They can't just turn their head and, you know, think that kid's just a bad kid or what have you.
Right.
They're obligated to look for those cases where there could possibly be a suspected disability.
All right. So what would the role be for a parent as far as an IEP? What are the things that they should know going into a meeting or going, you know, maybe even getting feedback back from the actual testing? What are some of the things they should think about?
Well, if a student does meet criteria and are eligible to receive an IEP, the team would sit down. It's a team that, and one very important member of that team is the parent.
Right.
They would review all the information from the evaluation. Everyone that was a part of that eval would then submit the reports, and we would sit in a meeting just like this, and we would discuss the results of that evaluation, and then you put the program together. How are we going to meet the needs based on that evaluation? And then goals are put together to address areas of need.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an annual process. Once a student receives an IEP, we have to review that annually. There are timelines that are that you don't have a choice about. Every school district has to abide by those timelines.
Okay, and in the planning for that particular child, what are you asking parents to do even at home to kind of solidify your plan to meet the needs and then the parent?
I think the important thing for parents to know is that they are a key member of that process. They are a key team member. And a very important part of the IEP is the parent concerns that are added to that. Their input is very important because they're the expert on that child. When you're talking about the IEP process and you're talking about where the child is currently, his test results, those kind of things, and then start working through the goals and objectives and maybe what supports need to be put into place, it's very important that that parent gives their input, because all of us parents of children with disabilities are doing accommodations at home each and every day that we don't even think about. So that's very important input for that process, for schools to know that. And again, it's a collaborative effort. It's not the parent's responsibility to figure out what supports or what goals, but it's working together with the team to do that. Another important part is when you're mentioning evaluations, is parents need to understand that they need to ask questions. There are no stupid questions, and there's someone at that meeting obligated to explain all those reports to them and what the different results mean, because a lot of times it just lots of acronyms and lots of numbers.
Yeah, we love acronyms in special ed.
Yeah. So there is no dumb question, and it's an integral part that they ask those questions. And you know, the professionals, the staff, they know what all that means, and they just kind of buzz through it. Whereas as a parent, our job is to kind of slow that down and say, hey, wait a minute, can you please explain this, this, and this, so I can understand what it means and what it means for my child.
Right, right. So you have some experience with PTA, right? Or mm-hmm. PTS, what do they call it for those?
We have a group in Dearborn right. that was formerly the Dearborn Special Ed Parent Advisory Committee. And that's a division of the Wayne County Parent Advisory Committee. It's a group of parents of children with special needs receiving special ed services that meets at the county level. We have a Dearborn level. Last year, we changed that group and became a special ed PTA. Reason being, obviously, the name recognition. It afforded us to become a 501(c) status, so we can do fundraising and you know, create kind of more of a substantial newsletter, get the word out a little better.
Can you also advocate to get things changed in the federal government and things like that, right?
Right, right. And we, I think the main focus of our special ed PTA is really getting information to parents. We go to the meetings at a state at the county level. We bring that information back to the local parents about what's going on. Every month we have meetings that we bring speakers in on different special education topics. So an integral part of being a parent of a child with a disability is really learning the process, learning the laws. I like to say to parents, it's your new second, third, or fourth full-time job. Whether you want it or not, it's yours. And the goal is to have the best services for your child, and the best way to do that is to be well-informed and a collaborative partner with the schools.
That's correct.
Yeah, to be the voice, to be out there and be active and proactive, I guess, as you would say.
Right.
It is, like you said, a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that can get very stressful. And so I'm wondering what there are as far as mechanisms for or outlets for people that get stressed out at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it is different than raising someone who doesn't have the special needs. You might still have struggles with because of behaviors and things like that. But, you know, a lot of these behaviors can be, they're taught. So you can change the behavior by teaching a new behavior and redirecting kids.
Right.
Sometimes that's not the case
with
someone who's special needs. So what are some of the avenues that parents could, like you said about just kind of collaborating and bonding with other people, that support group.
I think going back to that group, the best I found over the years, the best resources for myself as a parent with a child with a disability is other parents of kids with disabilities. Whether it's the same disability or something different, you can always learn something. You always have that in common, commiserate together, celebrate together. If you have a particular disability that your child has that may have an organization attached to it. You could join that organization, getting support that way. You know, now with the internet, there's blogs that you can connect with people anywhere and everywhere. You know, and I just think that human connection is just very important for support, because it is difficult, but it's what we know and we do it, you know. So if it's your first child or your fourth child, you know, obviously there's a little different perspective there and the severity of the disability, but like I said, I think that support from other parents is huge.
And I would agree, too, that not just for parents, but for the children themselves. Is mm-hmm. there anywhere where they all get together and gather and celebrate and do activities together as a group? And
well, actually, our Dearborn Special Ed PTA, we have meetings throughout the year that are parent meetings, but in the summer we have once a month we have kind of like swim parties and
so
get-togethers, to meet, you know, the other, so the kids can kind of get together and you know, and obviously encouraging parents to find activities, you know, extracurricular activities, whether, you know, their child is able to be included in, you know, just a regular Parks and Rec program, or, you know, if there is programs for kids with special needs. My son participated in the Miracle League baseball program, which is for kids with special needs.
Okay.
You know, so there's lots of different things that you can do. And if you have a support group, you know, that is part of your child's disability, they obviously have recreational things and things for people to connect. The main thing is, as a parent, is to actively pursue those things.
Right. So even you might even have to carpool or anything like that, right?
Or start your own if you if you want to connect with other parents, see if you can start getting a play group together or something like that.
Okay.
It's all about the relationships. I agree with Clarice. Yeah. That's really what that special ed PTA is all about. It's giving them useful information. I think it's critical. Get the information. And start building connections with people that just like this group came together. Margaret, you being a parent facilitator and your involvement in our school district brought us together. Right. I think whenever we do that, we start being collaborative with one another. The information gets out there, and if we ever have a dispute, it's generally about communication. It's not about, I think, teachers and are all in for the right reason. They're trying to help kids, and they want the best for just like their own children. So if there is a breakdown in that, it's always around communication. So whatever we can do to collaborate with one another, give useful information, I think it just solves all the issues that could come up.
Go ahead, Claire.
I was just going to say, I think another part of connecting, too, which when you have a child with a disability, you tend to focus on that disability. And what the special education law IDEA is, what it promotes is inclusion of kids with disabilities with their typical developing peers.
Right.
So I think another part that tends to get sidetracked is joining the special ed PTA is district-wide, but joining your own school PTA and getting your kids involved in the school activities that are actually at their building, whether they're in a general ed classroom or, center-based program, whatever the severity of the disability, connecting with those families right within your community is important, because in the long run that child needs to be exposed to the community.
Right, I agree. And so, it's interesting because my own story here that I want to share with you as a PTA vice president, when my kids were young, it really changed my life. It opened a lot of doors for me. I did build a lot of support with a lot of the parents, and we had a lot of camaraderie. And once I did PTA, then I decided, well, I can do more than this. I can become a noon supervisor. Then I went off to be a noon supervisor, and I worked with the special needs population when I was a noon supervisor. Then it was like, well, I could go to school. This would be good. So it was this empowerment thing, but it was like one little baby step led to something else. And I think that's true, like you're saying, in both the special needs population and the regular ed population. And it's like, all of these things come together, and they have to be a combined effort. People have to see each other working as a whole. You know, it's like, do you see the donut or do you see the hole in the donut, right? It's like everybody together is going to contribute and make a difference. So that's really powerful. Now, you have a notebook here that's from where? We were going to talk a little bit about this. It's some kind of advocacy book.
Well, let me just say first, I work for Michigan Alliance for Families.
Yes.
What we are is a grant-funded project of we are the designated parent training information center for the state of Michigan.
Right.
We receive our funding through the Michigan Department of Education as well as the U.S. Department of Education.
Okay.
What we are is a support organization that we work with parents, offering them information, education, and support all around the special education system.
What kind of training can they get? Can it lead to a job for them? Or is it just so they can manage and hang on and hold things together?
Well, our goal is to teach parents how to be the best advocate for their own child.
Okay.
A lot of parents feel like they need an outside person to come in and speak for them in a meeting.
Mm.
And like Michael had said, that relationship with the school is an integral part. So you as the parent are the one who has the lasting relationship with the school. That's why it's important for you to learn the laws and the procedures so you can be an effective advocate for your child. So that's what we do. I meet with parents one-on-one to help them learn about the IEP process. We offer workshops all over the state for parents on all different types of special education topics. We also have information on disabilities. And we have a wonderful website, www.michiganallianceforfamilies.org, that has all this information, as well as a calendar of events all over the state. As part of this project, we partner with many organizations around the state that also support families with kids with disabilities.
Okay.
One of which is Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services.
Okay.
They, again, are also a state-funded organization mm-hmm. that does advocacy for special education as well as other areas. And okay. the manual I have here is called the Special Education and Advocates Manual. And like I said, it's put out by the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services.
Mm-hmm.
By calling their 800 number, any parent in the state can get this manual. Their 800 number is 800-288-5923.
Give it one more time.
That number is 800-288-5923.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. This is called their Special Education and Advocates Manual.
Okay.
And it's just a really great tool for any parent or person who works with families with kids with disabilities, because it gives you, it's not like reading the law, but it cites the law, and it gives you little hints to use when you're trying to communicate with your school, and tips. And we use it all the time in working with the families that we work with Michigan Alliance for Families. This organization also comes and does a lot of workshops for us as well.
Wow, that's beautiful. And you know, Michael, you and I were talking earlier about some of the breakdown that happens in schools and how parents react or overreact. And instead of dealing with the problem at hand and the people that are involved in it, they go to the top. They go to the superintendent, or they just like, that's it, I've had enough. Can we just talk a little bit about that and what might be the best protocol for parents when things are, the issues are a little hot at school?
And I think that's... you know, I had the privilege to be in a general ed administrator and now a special ed director. So I've been in the buildings, and I can tell you that whenever parents have concerns, whether a student has an IEP or not, it's just best practice to go right to, whether it be the teacher that you may have an issue, just to kind of, you know, it's all about communication again. Find out exactly what there might just be something that was misunderstood. Try to resolve it with your teacher. It's very important to build a strong relationship, because it is a team effort to if you want that child to progress and mm-hmm. do their very best, mm-hmm. I think it's very important to be a team. And so I would say, you know, you go right to the teacher, and if that does not get resolved, go to your building administrator. Let them know. Try to work it out right there on site, because whether if it's an elementary school, you're going to be in that school for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, I would encourage that to be a real positive experience for you and your child when you're in our school. So if it can't be resolved, maybe it's special ed related, where the building administrator is unsure or whatever, and I work very closely with them. They'll let me know if there's something that they're not comfortable with, and I'll give them guidance, but I'll also give parents guidance. They can contact their special ed director, and I try to walk them through that. Go through, just like you would in any other issue, you know, go through the chain to make sure mm-hmm. that you've, because a lot of times, even in the complaint process, they'll ask you, have you gone back and let the person know directly that you've had a... you know, give them a chance to resolve the conflict
right.
prior to,
right.
you know.
Right. Sometimes it's just keeping our cool, you know,
yeah.
Not blowing things out of proportion and just kind of playing on the playing field and saying, well, I'm not sure, I don't understand what you did here. Can you explain to me again? And what was my son or daughter's role in this? And I think also is a lot of the meeting time with the child, with the student, or are they excluded from some of the meeting? Like, for example, when we were talking about the testing part, I'm sorry, I'm just going to kind of go back here. But the child is right there to hear the scores,
depending
and
on the age,
to hear where they're at and everything.
I encourage the child
level.
To be a part of that,
yeah.
especially at the secondary level. They
yeah.
should be involved.
Depending on the age of the child, they should start being included in that process, because as an individual with a disability, they need to learn those skills to self-advocate as they
right.
grow up and become an adult. And just going back to what you were saying about that communication process and having a child with a disability, when you're sitting down at this meeting and you're talking about this, it is an emotional thing. It's your child. You know, that's why we encourage parents to always bring somebody with them as a second set of ears to kind of support them, because someone might say something and you might take offense to that, and so you're stuck on that and you miss the next two things that that have been said.
Oh, I'm glad you're saying
this. So you've got somebody there kind of holding you to...
They glue you together.
Right, taking notes for you and that kind of thing. But, you know, that's something that schools and administrators need to recognize is we're talking about an individual, we're talking about this person's child. They need to be sensitive to that because, you know, there are situations where maybe the child isn't being presented in a positive light by the school, and that in and of itself causes a breakdown in communication because the parent is going to be receptive as to what they're
and
saying.
And defensive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, again, just keeping that collaborative spirit and showing that you're a parent that you want to work with the school, I think in the long run is going to create a better environment, create a more collaborative environment,
and
therefore things are going to get resolved a lot easier. Again, that's what we're trying to promote with parents. I talk to a lot of parents either before their IEP meeting or after. I'm not a direct advocate, so I do not go to school meetings.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of what I do is to try and help them keep their cool. I kind of let them vent to me and say, oh, the teacher said this, and then they did this. And so I say, okay, none of that is relevant in the meeting. Let's make an outline. Let's, you know, so that person can be focused about what their goals are, what, you know, what their concerns are for their particular child, because that's an important part of being a member of that team.
Right.
Because once you start kind of going off and saying, you know, then this happened and then that happened, you lose your audience, I guess you'd say.
And your focus, it's all about the child.
Right.
It's not about
your emotion.
Yeah,
it's about
and about each one of us.
It's
really, if you really focus on that child and what, and you usually come out in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
When everyone may have a different agenda or something, a hidden agenda,
right,
then it can go off in the wrong direction. But overall, if everyone at the meeting is really focusing on the child and what they need and the supports that child may need, I think you come out in a better place.
Right. All right. Well, thank you. We're going to be right back. We're going to take a little break here, okay? And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 on your FM dial. And I'm Margaret King Ahmed, your host of Parent Connection. And we'll be right back.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard, ride a bike, or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
And be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
At letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Listening to WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 on your FM dial. I'm Margaret King Ahmed, your host of Parent Connection. Thank you for tuning in. This program can be heard every fourth Monday of every month from 6 to 7. And we're talking today with Michael Shelton and Claire Brick, both representatives from the Special Education field, and we're going to get right back into knowing your rights as a parent when you are raising a child with special needs. So again, thank you both for being here. I really appreciate your company and your words of wisdom. And we were talking a little bit during the break what we kind of wanted to talk about next time, you know, as we came back in, and we're going to talk about the transition plan. When our kids get beyond school, we want to know exactly what can they do, what kind of what's out there for them to help support them. So both of you can, you know, throw it back and forth to each other and just kind of let's cover the basis for a transition plan.
Okay, Claire did touch on that. That's part of the IEP. And once a student is 16 years old, we actually start at 15 doing like a career cruising. It's going to start targeting areas that the student are good in, you know, jobs that they may be proficient at and might want to examine in their years at high school. So we start doing that at age 15. We actually start writing the transition plan within the IEP at age 16, and we're really looking at post-secondary outcomes. How are we going to support in the before graduation that child so that they're successful once they leave high school? That's really what the transition plan is all about. So we really outline a lot of different things that we want to do as a school district and as parents and the student. They're all, what are actual things are we going to do so that we prepare our students for post-secondary? And so I think it's a great tool.
And part of that process, like you had asked earlier about the student being included in the IEP, is really talking to that student and I don't know if that career cruising is similar to the educational development plan.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a process where you're interviewing the student and, you know, where do you see yourself? What are your likes? What are your dislikes? You know, where do you see yourself living? All those kind of things. And then that way you can incorporate things that are going to be giving that student those skills while they're still in school to be successful outside of school.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I remember, you know, growing up with my sister, who has Down syndrome. She, you know, we treated her just like she was like the rest of us. You know, you have jobs to do, you have this, and you have to go to school, and yada yada yada. But it was interesting. I don't think any of us saw her beyond the school years. And in fact, the doctor actually told my mother my sister would not live beyond 21 years of age. But oh my gosh, I mean, I know there's quite a few Down syndrome folks out there in their 60s and even 80s. So all that was back then. That's what they knew. That's as much as they knew. So I think it's really important, first of all, that we have the information and it's correct information and it's current information. And I do think it's really important, like we were talking about earlier, just advocating for our children, but that we do see beyond that day, the day, that moment, and the future. Where do we see our child? And I think that's really hard for parents. You get so caught up in the everyday trials and tribulations. And what do you suggest? How do you?
And even within the IEP, they're annual, so you're trying to present a plan that you want to put in place for that year. But I think it's also important to think 3 years, 5 years, and post-secondary. It kind of guides you in some of the decisions that you make when you develop that plan. So,
well, and I think also, like you had said, back then, the life expectancies of individuals, depending on their disability, were limited, and now people are living that much longer. Technology and medical science and all that kind of thing, people are living longer. We're seeing more what their abilities are. Like I said before, I think the expectations were fairly low in terms of people living in the community and being independent, but it's definitely in the parents' best interest even though it's difficult to think beyond that, because they're living longer, parents aren't going to be around to guide their life and protect them. So that's why putting these things in place and helping their independence is so important.
And Claire's done a great job with that. With her and I have talked at special ed PTA meetings on the side, informing parents to prepare for when their son or daughter is no longer receiving service, you know, maybe beyond 26, it could be even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to share with that conversation, you know, some of the different choices that parents have to prepare for their children living longer and
right,
and that
right.
type of thing.
Well, I mean, I think there previously was a tendency to obtain guardianship
right.
over
I did that with my sister
a young adult
when our parents passed.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Of a young adult approaching 18, whereas the new trend is called self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals with disabilities depending on, you know, regardless of their level of disability, still have abilities to make decisions. And there's many tools that you can put into place that, with the Michigan Alliance for Families, we refer to as alternatives to guardianship.
Mm-hmm.
There are many things that you can do, a special needs trust or fiscal intermediary, different things to still maintain a level of control over whether it be medical, finances, those kind of things.
Housing,
still enabling that individual to maintain their independence and dignity as an individual without taking their guardianship from them.
Right. So it's an empowerment kind of thing, really,
right.
if you think about
right.
it. I'm thinking about my sister, that she actually, you know, I had to put her on a list. And that list was very, very long mm-hmm. for her to have housing.
Right.
And I knew that she really was high functioning, mm-hmm. and being in a group home wasn't the best setting, that she could actually live independently or have one roommate. And I really stress this with parents that we need to see them as functional and capable and empower them every chance we get to do that,
well,
provide them
right.
opportunities for choices and to say, we know you can do it, you know, this is you, this is going to be your life, and you know, how do you see this for yourself, and to include them in that formula.
Right. Well, and it's all about seeing their abilities as
yes.
opposed to their disabilities.
Yes.
And in the past, the way the system was in place, under the Department of Community Mental Health, they have, you know, managed care provider networks that help do the housing and those kind of things.
Right.
And there was a system, and then they would take the individuals and sort of plug them in to, we got a house over here, we got a spot over here, we got a job over here. Whereas now the trend is, again, self-determination. We want to find out how do they see themselves living? What kind of job do they see themselves in? And then kind of, you know, shape their education and beyond to fit that, as opposed to, you know, I putting them in a house with, you know, here's three people and there's a spot, let's stick them in, as opposed
right.
to saying, who are your friends, who would you like to live with,
filling the slot
because of
money or budget or
right.
yeah, the compliance. And
I mean
right.
none of us would, you know, tolerate
mm-hmm.
saying, here's a house over here, there's three people living here, you're going to
yeah,
live there too.
Exactly.
You know, so I mean, it's just really stepping back and with respect and thinking, this is an individual and they have preferences and desires as well, and we need to respect that and need to try and work with them to fulfill those things.
Right. My sister actually did that. I mean, she's 44 now and she is her own guardian, and I'm just thrilled, and she's amazing. I mean, she's
yeah.
got her own cell phone. She's got, you know, she's just really, she's connected, she's got her own little business, she's really, it's amazing. And I think those groups that advocate for them, you know, like the community living services, and we were talking about some of those folks that work in those agencies are amazing.
You are right.
Very committed, very loyal, and very uplifting, and
right.
advocate very well. And my sister knows her rights. I mean,
right.
she's actually had, you know, people fired because
yeah.
she met with her rights advocate and went over the rights that she has and how people treat her, and you know.
Well, it's keeping those expectations high, and they're going to rise to the occasion. And Michigan Alliance for Families, we also partner with the ARC organization, which is
yes.
a national organization, again, supporting children and adults with disabilities. And they have many of the, because with Michigan Alliance for Families, we're parent mentors, we're not direct advocates. And there are situations that arise where an advocate is needed if a child's being kicked out of school, or if you know, the IEP's not being followed or something. So we do have advocates that we do refer to, and many of those work through the ARC organizations.
And they have a new office. Right, I had a chance to go over and visit Claire and the group over there.
It's
in Dearborn.
Right. Oh, I work out of the ARC of Dearborn.
Yes.
And so, we have a beautiful new office. They've been saving for years for it. And we have an adult day program there for adults with disabilities.
When you say adults, though, what age are we talking?
Over 26.
Over 26.
Right. And they are, it's a recreational program.
Oh.
So they do community service, they do mm-hmm. volunteer work, they do recreational activities. And it's right in a neighborhood. It's right on Park and Military, so it's in a neighborhood. It's close to shopping. So they do lots of those kinds
great
of things.
Great location.
Yeah. Yep. So they do those kind of things. And actually, just this past week, our director there has had a couple conversations with personnel at Howe School to try and do some sort of outreach with transition, getting those Howe students out and working with our ARC organization in the community, doing some experience, whether it be in volunteer work or recreational, that kind of thing.
So the neighborhood's receptive to it, the mm-hmm. businesses. Do you find there's more and more businesses getting on board with, making sure that they offer opportunities for our special needs population to find work and be employed?
Well, I think it's difficult right now because the economy, mm-hmm. the jobs in years past that maybe individuals with disabilities were able to perform in different, whether it be a grocery store setting or a Walmart or something like that, because the economy is so poor and there's so many people out of work, that's tending to push our population out of that job market, unfortunately.
Yep. That is unfortunate. Yeah.
So... these advocacy organizations are constantly looking for new opportunities for these individuals, but at the same time, that's why volunteering is very important, so mm-hmm. they can still be getting experience in doing things, even though it's volunteer versus a paid position.
Right. Go ahead, Michael.
And I have a firsthand experience, too. I have a young man, he's actually my age now, 25 years ago when I was a special ed teacher at Howe. And by the way, Howe School was really for our moderate cognitively impaired kids, our severely multiply impaired kids. We're actually moving those classrooms into general ed settings.
Wow.
We moved a classroom over at Michael Berry. That's why the supervisor at Howe School is now partnering, looking for possibilities to get students into other settings that mm-hmm. Instead of a segregated building.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already noticing,
it's
so exciting.
Right.
It's been terrific. And so I had a young man 25 years ago where he held down a job. As long as I work with that place of employment and mm-hmm. told them exactly and give the proper training mm-hmm. and feedback, I recall getting a phone call say, do you have any other students? Because I know he shows up every day on time and puts an honest day of work in. Mm-hmm. He is money. So, but like Claire was saying, those jobs have been narrow now. The job mm-hmm. even the job market has shifted, mm-hmm. kind of jobs that they're available now. So he struggled, but community living services picked up the slack, gave him some other training. I'm actually going to be, he's into his new apartment in a couple of weeks, so I'm so excited about that.
Congratulations.
Go in and check it out.
Well, and I think what it boils down to is the shift, like I said, in years past, they'd have different organizations that would come on board and say, yes, we'll hire this population of people and train them for specific jobs. Whereas now, I think the shift needs to be changed to that individual, what their interests are, kind of more individual, pursuing of organizations. Like if you've got a kid who's really into music, instead of plugging him into, well, McDonald's works with us, what can we do at McDonald's? Say, hey, there's a music store, Dearborn Music or Anderson Music, and say, hey, we've got a kid, here are the things he can do. Is there anything he can do for you in it? So getting it more on an individual basis. And I think that's how you're going to overcome that and get these students out into the workforce.
Right. Well, I have to ask you, in your worst case scenario, what was the worst thing that's ever happened with parent and their child making the jump or the leap into advocating and moving that child forward? I mean, do you have cases where parents just even become so emotionally distraught or stressed out that there might even be abuse going on? Or, I mean, how do you detect or determine those kinds of things in opposed to, you know, we're seeing the light side, I mean the bright side and stuff, but I know there's some dark side to this too. So,
In the year that I've been the director of special ed, we have not had one due process complaint.
Wow.
We've kind of changed our model of, we have much more inclusion now.
Okay.
We are co-teaching in our secondary level. We have fewer students in just basic classrooms with just special ed students with a special ed teacher.
So beef up support.
So we've been supporting students in the general ed setting much more.
That's
so
wonderful.
But that, that's been a change in philosophy for for the adults in our system. But as a whole, you can see firsthand children and our expectation for what they can do has just changed dramatically.
And
we're really really think that the achievement levels of our students in that subgroup will display that as well. We think that we know in our heart it's the right thing to do. You can see it with the children that you're working with every day.
Wow.
And so we think we're going to have the data here shortly to prove it.
I was going to say, just touching on that, I mean, studies have shown that kids with disabilities who are included with their typical peers learn more, whether regardless of if it's at the same level, if they're in a fifth grade math class and they're doing first grade math, they're still learning more than if they were in a segregated environment. I think sometimes, you know, that change is uncomfortable for staff as well as parents. Some parents are more comfortable in that having their student in that segregated environment.
Right.
So sometimes that makes it difficult. And I was just going to touch on, you were saying the worst case scenario. Luckily here in Dearborn, again, it goes back to communication. And, you know, I think Dearborn is following, you know, process and procedure. Because I work for a statewide organization, I hear a lot of terrible, terrible things happening in terms of, you know, different communities where all the IEPs go home in backpacks and get signed and sent back, and the parents have no idea that that's illegal to do that. Kids getting repeatedly suspended regardless of their disability or sent home. They do something that's called... It's a suspension, but the school's not calling a suspension. They'll call and say, "Oh, he's being troubled today. Come pick him up. He's being troubled today. Come pick him up." And they're not calling it suspension, but it is.
Yeah.
Even though it's a manifestation of his disability, the parent doesn't know to say, "Hey, you know, we need a functional behavior assessment to determine why he's doing that." You know, parents don't always feel comfortable saying, "Well, I'm not going to come get him."
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of thing. So there's a lot of that going around. There's a lot of you know, systematic problems around the state. But again, with Michigan Alliance for Families, our goal is to get that information out there so parents know, you know, what their rights are and what they can do. And because I think a lot of that stems from parents not questioning, parents not asking, parents not objecting to those kind of things happening.
Right. So due process. What is due process? What does that look like? How does that happen?
There's kind of a chain of what needs to happen. If you have an IEP and you either disagree with it or something's not being followed, again, you want to start with the informal process. Like Michael was saying, was, you know, you want to talk to your teacher. You're not getting anywhere with the teacher. You
go to the direct source, right?
Right. You want to go to the administrator, go to the special ed director. You know, follow that chain of command.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, do that in an appropriate way. You want to keep track of your conversations. You want to keep a paper trail, a log, so you have recourse. Then the next step would be you want to request mediation.
Mm-hmm.
There are organizations, independent organizations, that will come in, state funded, to mediate the process. A lot of times that will resolve an issue because that sort of gets everybody on their best behavior and puts the personalities aside, because they're making sure it's following the correct process. They're not on either side. They're just following the process.
Right.
If you're still not getting to a resolution, then at that point it's time to file a state complaint. What we were touching on earlier, I think we were talking maybe off air, but was you need to make sure if you're going to file a complaint, it has to be a complainable offense. You can't just say the teacher was mean to me, she told me I was stupid, or shut the door in my face. It has to be attached to a specific rule or law that's being broken.
Is that in that?
It is in this manual.
Manual. Yeah. Okay.
And it's also on the Michigan Department of Ed website. All the information that we promote through Michigan Alliance for Families is approved by the Michigan Department of Education,
okay.
Because that's where our funding comes from, and the Federal Department of Education. So any information that we give is all approved by the Michigan Department of Ed, and you can either find it on their website or Wayne RESA, which is the Regional Education Service Agency.
So what is their web? It's Wayne RESA?
It's RESA.net.
RESA.net.
Okay. So they have a whole section of special education with a lot of different information on there as well.
Okay.
Go to Michigan Department of Ed, just Google it, and you can go to their website, and they have a search, and you can, everything.
Any topic.
Even a sample complaint form is, a model form is, at that website. They'll walk very transparent. This information is available and at the fingertips of anyone that would like that information. So
right. And then the next step beyond filing a complaint would be a due process complaint, which is essentially boils down to taking the district to court.
We had that happen?
No.
Yeah.
That's because you're at the helm.
it's trying to resolve those issues.
Yes.
You know, there are those parents around the state that say, I don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm filing due process because I'm mad and they're going to pay, you know.
Okay, so again, it's out of the emotional state of mind.
Which is not productive or conducive to you know, promoting good relations for your student. Again, going back to the student is the focus of this, and creating the best environment and the best education for that student.
Yeah.
And it's not just because of my leadership. We have great teachers and administrators in our district that are all focused on that same goal. It's about the children. So I've been fortunate. We haven't come across where we've had a parent that just has an own agenda and angry. Mm-hmm. We've been able to come up with solutions to some of the issues that have been brought up. So we've tried to work with our parents. We're all in it for the right reason.
Yeah, that's great news. And so do you see an increase then in some of the activity with parents being involved in meetings and part of the memberships or groups?
We've been trying to encourage our, but a lot of our parents, we've changed our time. We've done early mornings. We've tried evening meetings. But a lot of our parents are involved in their own PTA at their own building. So just like our children are included in all settings, so are parents.
Broken, don't go in and try to fix it. So maybe that's why they just stay involved in the PTA.
And what I find, too, with Michigan Alliance for Families is parents that things are going well for them, they're not seeking out the information because things are going well.
Right.
Or they don't know. Maybe things aren't going as well as they could, but they don't know any different.
Right.
So, you know, our goal is to try and get the information to them, to tell them that we're having these meetings. Like Michael said, now that we are a PTA, we do monthly meetings as opposed to our meetings previously were maybe three or four times a year. So we do alternate day and evening in hopes to kind of
accommodate,
have the best possible audience. But again, like I said, I find that parents, until there's a problem, they're not going to seek out that information.
Yeah, that's the challenge for me, too, as a parent educator doing the parent talk in the district.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, unless there's a real problem,
they're not gonna call Margaret.
call Margaret. Yeah. So, listen, you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 on the FM dial, and you're listening to Parent Connection. I'm Margaret King Ahmed, your host, and we were talking today with our guest in the studio, Michael Shelton and Claire Brick, and the representatives for the special needs population, and we were talking about knowing your rights, and I really hope and pray that you really got some information here that was helpful for you, and that you become a proactive parent, and stay involved, and stay on top of the latest, and the best news out there that helps you advocate for your children in the schools and beyond school and into the future. So, Michael and Claire, thank you.
Thank you.
This is just wonderful. Go ahead, Claire, give it to us.
I just wanted to one last time give some information about the Michigan Alliance for Families. We offer workshops, individual support for parents. We have an 800 number that will route to the closest person to you to assist you. The number is 800 5-5. And then the next step beyond filing a complaint would be a due process complaint, which is essentially boils down to taking the district to court.
Hello, everybody out there. You are listening to WHFR Dearborn. I am Jessica here with just a little indie today for you. And today is kind of a special day for me because one of my favorite bands came out with a new album today. And that would be I Fight Dragons. So, I'm super excited. I got my copy today of the new album, Kaboom. So, I'm going to be playing lots of it today. Right now, we're going to take a non-commercial announcement break real quick to start to end off that last show, that last locally produced talk show here to WHFR. And when we get back, we're going to start in on the awesomeness that is just a little indie. So stay tuned right here to WHFR Dearborn.
This Halloween, do your trick-or-treating at WHFR. Just call 313-845-9676 or email whfr@hfcc.edu. On Halloween Day, say trick-or-treat for a grab bag full of goodies. This Halloween, email or call WHFR. The treats are on us.
WebAdvisor is a secure internet program that allows HFCC students and faculty to safely access their college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, current students may register for classes, drop and add classes, pay for classes, retrieve grades, view and print schedules, get updates on financial aid info, check account balances. Log on to WebAdvisor at my.hfcc.edu or from the HFCC homepage at www.hfcc.edu.
The WHFR Monday Forum. An hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Hi, this is Amy Milan from Stars, and you're listening to WHFR 89.3 in Dearborn, Michigan, the station making waves.